WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. Before the war broke out in the Balkans in 1991, Yugoslavia was one of the leading arms exporters in the world. Since the war began, the United Nations has imposed an arms embargo on the region as a means to contain the fighting. But while the embargo is in place on paper, in reality, it has not stopped the flow of weapons to the Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian forces. Earlier this week, in just 3 days, Croatian forces overran the rebel Serb military in the Krajina region, a Serbian stronghold within the Croatian borders. Until recently, the Serb forces were considered the best armed and best trained in the region. Their defeat this week could change the balance of power there. To provide some background on the arming of the former Yugoslav republics, we turn to Paul Beaver, editor of Jane's Balkan Sentinel, which is a sister magazine of Jane's Defense Weekly. I asked him if he was surprised at the Croatian victory in the Krajina this week.
Simply put, I think I was surprised at the speed they did it. I wasn't surprised at their military capability. We've been watching that building up for the last 6 or 7 months. And I think in terms of equipment and training, we were fully aware of the capabilities. But we did expect the Krajina Serbs to put up a stiffer resistance. It seems to us that all they did was basically fight a very short holding action and then withdraw and evacuate. And that was... That, I think, is the key to it. It's the Serbs who fled rather than the Croats who are being who are better armed than we thought.
When the war began, Croatia had almost no army to speak of. They lost about a third of their territory to the Serbian rebel forces. How were they able to build up their arsenal of weapons?
I think we have to understand what the position was like in early 1992. Croatia was recognized by the European Union and later by the United Nations. It was an interesting situation because 22% of the territory was held by the majority of ethnic Serbs, and they've been there for about 500 years. So it gives them gave them quite a right to be on the ground. They didn't see eye to eye with President Tudjman in Zagreb, a definite difference of politics, left versus right wing. And at that stage, both sides had kept weapons from the former JNA, from the People's Army of Yugoslavia. So they both started off with a sort of an amount of small arms and ammunition, nothing too exciting. The advantage that Croatia has had since then is that not only did it have some of the major repair facilities around Zagreb and down at Karlovac and down through at Split and Pula, it had major airfields and had about 12 airfields, both tarmac and grass, which can be used for flying in supplies. So what we saw happening was initially the formation of a militia, the Defence Council, which was a creation of nothing more than an armed police force. And the military police became very proficient. That led, I think, to the development of an army. And by early 1993, there were signs that a real army was being formed.
And a real army means real arms.
Absolutely.
And for instance, apparently they have a number of MiG-21 fighter planes, also helicopters and I assume tanks and everything else. How are they able to get those armaments into a region that has an arms embargo?
Well, coincidentally with the formation of the Republic of Croatia and their decision to create an armed forces as opposed to a militia, we saw the withdrawal from Eastern Europe of the former Soviet forces. We saw the reunification of Germany. And suddenly, the arms bazaars from Berlin to Vladivostok were full of former Soviet equipment, MiG-21 fighters, Mi-24 attack helicopters, shoulder-launched air-to-air missiles, 120-millimeter mortars. You name the piece of equipment, it was around. One of the things that happened was as the Russian troops left East Germany, they lost a lot of the paperwork, which allowed them to lose a lot of the equipment. And I think a lot of generals became very rich as a result.
Well, how do you smuggle in a MiG-21 fighter plane?
very easily. You take the wings off and you put it into a series of containers and you deliver it. And you deliver it by road or you deliver it by air. And they've got enough airfields which are perfectly capable of taking aircraft that can carry 10, 12, 15-ton loads, aircraft like the Ilyushin 76, which can use grass airfields. So it's relatively easy, with the as long as you have the connivance of your customs authorities, to get equipment in. And you just have to look at the land borders and how much traffic uses the Croatian borders. On any one day, there are several thousand container lorries going one way or the other. You can't possibly inspect them all.
Can you tell us who specifically is supplying the Croats?
It's very difficult to be actually precise as to who the major suppliers are. What you can do is easily identify the current countries of origin of the equipment. You just have to look at TV footage and you can see Russian-built MiGs and Mi-24 helicopters and air defense missile systems, Swedish missiles. You can see German sidearms. You can see Singapore-built anti-tank rockets. You can see anti-tank missiles from China. There's even talk of surface-to-air missile launchers, a Stinger, which has arrived via Afghanistan, the ones which the CIA originally supplied to the Mujahideen back in the 1980-81 time when they were fighting the Soviets. Basically, you name the piece of equipment and you can find it, some example, in Croatia. And the problem is working out whether or not the governments which supplied it were in connivance or whether this was freelance operations in the black market.
Well, is there any way that you've been able to penetrate this black market of arms dealing?
We've basically used two ways to determine what we believe has been going into former Yugoslavia, Croatia and Bosnia in particular. The first is we have access to photographs and TV footage and people. So the raw intelligence that any country's intelligence organization would use, building up a picture of equipment. And the other thing we found, curiously, is that people have been talking about what's been happening, the suppliers themselves. I don't suppose that the job that people like Jane's do is any different to that of the countries in the region's own intelligence organizations. Everybody is looking for information. It's very critical to understand what's been imported and what's been made domestically. Croatia's been saying for the last 6 months or so that it's redeveloped its defense industry and it now makes everything that you see, that it's been rebuilding helicopters and MiGs and other things from supplies it found in warehouses when it took over the country. I'm afraid I take a pinch of salt with that. I don't think that's necessarily true at all. But there is a very good defense industry growing up in Croatia during the time of the former Federation of Yugoslavia, the Tito time. There was a lot of work carried out in Zagreb. For example, they had one of the best naval institutes for naval architecture in the world there. So there's a lot of work that goes on there. And certainly there's no doubt at all that the 9mm pistols that every soldier appears to be equipped with in the Croatian army have come from domestic lines, that they have back-engineered the Uzi 9mm submachine pistol of Israeli design, but all small stuff. All the big equipment has come from outside or has been mainly sourced from outside.
It's expensive to build up an army. Where and how does a country like Croatia get enough money to be able to afford to buy the kinds of arms that you're describing?
They've probably spent in the last 12 months something like $650 million. Not really a lot of money when you consider that there's a large banking organization in Zagreb before the breakup. So I would imagine that there was some hard cash around. I've recently been talking to Australian police sources that tell me that during 1991, 92, 93, they were tracking ethnic Croats in Australia who were talking to their compatriots there, people who were very successful in business, who fled Yugoslavia in 1948 and in subsequent years had emigrated to Australia. And the Australian police believe that at least $250 million has been raised in Australia and New Zealand from ethnic Croats.
My guest is Paul Beaver, editor of Jane's Balkan Sentinel. More on the arming of the Balkans after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Beaver is editor of Jane's Balkan Sentinel. We're talking about the arming of the former Yugoslavia, the arms embargo, and who's supplying what to whom. Well, at the end of July, Malaysia said it would ignore the arms embargo and, I guess, in a very overt way, begin to send arms to Sarajevo, to the Bosnian government. How much covert supplying to the Bosnian government from Islamic countries?
Oh, I think the bulk of the arms have come in from the Islamic world. We know of Egyptian-registered ships that have been found at sea and diverted, and on board they've found hundreds of tons of equipment, armoured cars, anti-tank weapons, etc. We know that equipment has come in from Pakistan and from China, from Iran, from Malaysia, from Indonesia, from Egypt, from Algeria. The Islamic world is certainly very, very concerned about what's been happening in Bosnia and wants to help. What it doesn't have is the actual wherewithal to do the deliveries. With the exception, perhaps, of Turkey, and it's difficult to say whether Turkey is an Islamic country as it has a secular constitution, but with the exception of Turkey and possibly Egypt, there's no country which has the capability of actually supplying directly, physically taking in the arms. But of course, countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have got the money to be able to support it. And we had Sheikh Mohammed, the defense minister of the United Arab Emirates and the Crown Prince of Dubai, contributing $15 million from his own pocket to buying arms for and equipment and to support the Bosnian government. Just a week or two ago. I think that gives you an indication of the level in which people in the Islamic world feel that they must help their brothers in Bosnia.
So who's arming the Serbs? We've talked about the Croats, we've talked about the Muslims. Who's arming the Serbs?
Well, just as the black market's available for the Croats and the Bosnians, it's available for the Serbs, the Bosnian Serbs we're talking about now. The Serbs proper in Yugoslavia had the 12th largest arms industry in the world up until 1989, 1990. And they've still got a lot of factories in Serbia. They still can supply a lot of the equipment themselves, everything from fighter aircraft through tanks to warships. They don't really have the same problem. But the Bosnian Serbs do, and they've been getting equipment. We have seen the very latest Russian anti-aircraft missile, the SA-16 Igla-1E, as it's known in military parlance. That's been there. It's been there for a while. In April 1994, a British Royal Navy Sea Harrier jet was shot down over Garajda with one of those missiles. We know that there are some modifications that have been done to air defense missiles. We know that there has been a lot of equipment that has come, ammunition in particular, new types of ammunition for old types of guns to give them longer range or more lethal effect. There's only one place that can come from. That's the former Soviet Union, whether it's Russia or Ukraine or Kazakhstan or Tajikistan, whoever is supplying it, that's where it's come from.
Looking at the assault on the Krajina, it looked fairly sophisticated. It was a rather organized attack. How do you think the Croatian army got its training?
Oh, I was very impressed with what I saw of the Croat Armed Forces. I saw a disciplined group of people appeared to be a very good military order. We didn't have a lot of information coming out because, of course, the Croats had kidnapped the United Nations observers, and made it very difficult for the press to get in close. The media were unable to get close. But from what we saw, this was a very finely honed military operation. Back at the beginning of May, we'd seen the operation in western Slovenia to capture part there of the UN's protected area, which had been occupied by the ethnic Serbs who'd been living there for a good number of centuries. That operation didn't go that successfully. The Croats lost two MiG-21 fighters. They probably lost a helicopter. They lost quite a number of troops, and they overreacted. There's some very nasty accounts of forced, I suppose you could almost call it ethnic cleansing, of forced expulsion of people from villages and the firing of villages and certainly large numbers of people being killed. I think the military learned a lot of lessons from that, and we saw a lot of that being reshaped. How do they get to that stage? Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that's been taxing a lot of people. About the middle of last year, And we started to see familiar faces appearing at Zagreb Airport. And
what does that mean, familiar
faces?
What does that mean, well, familiar faces?
People that that were known in the defense community. And lo and behold, when I started to look back at some of the almanacs of U.S. forces, we discovered there were some generals there. And
can I just stop you there? Can you name names? Can you tell us who you're talking about?
Well, I can certainly tell you the names of the organization. When we looked at tried to find out exactly who was involved, we did some research in the outskirts of Washington, and there's this wonderful little town called Alexandria in Virginia. Coincidentally, it's where Janes has its American headquarters, and we discovered an organization there called Military Professional Resources Incorporated. Perfectly open, nothing clandestine about them. They are a group of retired generals, including a former deputy director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they have a State Department license to go to Croatia and to train. But it's not the sort of training that the Russians have been doing around the world, for example, or the French and the British do in their military training teams, which go to various countries. This training was very specific. It was what's called doctrinal training. What these American personnel were doing, and I must stress they're non-governmental, but they are licensed by the State Department, so it's perfectly legal, that they were teaching the whole sort of spirit of how to fight, how to organize. One of the things that happened in Tito's day in former Yugoslavia was that the fact that they didn't really have the use of initiative on the battlefield. It was very much the old Soviet system, where commands were passed down from the most senior general to a junior general to a colonel, etc., right the way down the ranks. There's no initiative. Now, one thing that the NATO forces have learned in the last 50 years, particularly from some of the operations they've had to get involved in, not as NATO but as individual countries, is that you need to have initiative. And initiative, it should be taken at the very lowest level. So this MPRI went in to train the sergeants and the corporals, the junior captains, the lieutenants, the people who will command on the battlefield, to take the initiative. And that's what we saw happening in the Krajina. Probably for the first time in the former Yugoslavia, we had sergeants who were exploiting a situation on the battlefield where they knew they could win.
The U.S. Senate just voted to lift the arms embargo. But from what you've been telling us, that there are many holes in the arms embargo. What do you think, if the actual embargo were lifted, would that change the balance of power in the region? Would it change the flow of weapons, the type of weapons?
I think there's no doubt at all. If the arms embargo is lifted, then we will see weapons flooding into the region, not, of course, just to Bosnia, because the people who tend to see themselves as allies of the Serbs and the former Soviet Union, for example, perhaps even Greece, would see it as their duty to supply arms, even if the embargo was still in place. So it would actually escalate the situation. And it's not really a panacea for Bosnia. It's all very well to say from tomorrow week, wouldn't happen in case of America, it would have to be 12 weeks' time. It's in 3 months' time, we'll provide you with tanks and long-range artillery and fighter aircraft. Fine, who's going to operate them? Who's going to train for them? About 3 or 4 months ago, we were talking to the head of the Bosnian government army and saying to him, what's your shopping list? If the arms embargo is lifted tomorrow, what do you want? T-72 main battle tanks or 155mm howitzers? And he said, well, of course, I'd like those in due course. I'd like the training courses for my people so I can actually get them trained up for this. But what I want now are sniper rifles, night vision goggles, are better anti-tank weapons, better anti-personnel mines, communication systems that can't be jammed or eavesdropped. I want to have those systems so I can defeat the Serbs where they've got the advantage in tanks and artillery. I want to be able to go to their artillery sites and blow them up. I want to be able to hit the tanks on the move with anti-tank missiles and anti-tank rockets. I don't necessarily want to shell them or to fight tank with tank. Bosnia isn't the desert of Iraq and Kuwait. You can't have a tank-to-tank fight. In Iraq, you can see or detect a tank at 1,000 kilometres. You'd be lucky at 100 metres to see a tank in Bosnia. It's so wooded and hilly. So he knew exactly what he wanted. He started to get that equipment, I believe. The Bosnian government had been training special forces, giving them special skills. A lot of people are prepared to give their services to the Bosnian government for this because they believe that they are a country which is being victimized. And I think that they are developing a very nice military formation. They're starting to, they've got rank insignia now, they've got a proper structure, and they've been firing the generals who don't do the job properly, those who are too political, or those who are relying upon old infantry tactics of and wasting men's lives. That's all stopped. So we're starting to see a development in the army. The arms embargo would help, but it won't be a panacea immediately. It will take 6, 8, 12 months.
My guest is Paul Beaver, and he's the editor of Jane's Balkan Sentinel, and we're talking about the buildup of arms in the Balkans. Well, let me ask you some questions about how you do your work, how you're able to gather this information and do the kind of investigative work that you do, and how much actual physical evidence do you need to have in order to say that a country is getting MiG-21 fighter planes, for example?
I like to go and pat the MiG-21 fighter planes on the, and just to make sure they're real. We discard about 80 to 90% of the information we get unless we've got good sources and good cooperation on it. We only trust the sources that we've known to be 100% right throughout the time. When new people come along, it takes them a long time to get in our confidence. We like to try, and we use enthusiasts, we use specialists, we use people who know the difference between a MiG-21 PFM and a MiG-21 MF and a MiG-21 BIS. It's an organization of specialists, and that's the sort of the only way you can put this together, is by bringing in lots and lots of sources, making sure the sources are right, and putting the information together. One person, one source will never work.
Are there people who try to plant misinformation, try to give you misinformation to get you off track?
Absolutely. The world is full of people with misinformation, from advertising executives down to people in ministries of defense. That's a real problem for us. We look at the information that comes in from abroad very carefully and try not to to use anybody's anything that comes up. There have been a few governments that we are circumspect about. The Iraqi government was always trying to get us to write nasty things about the Iranians. Interestingly enough, Tehran has never tried to make us write anything about anyone.
Paul Beaver, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Paul Beaver is editor of Jane's Balkan Sentinel, a sister magazine of Jane's Defense Weekly. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.